gracebiblechurch.org. There's links there to all of the Sunday school classes, by the way, not just this one. So if you want other lessons from other people, they're there also. So gracebiblechurch.org. That's where you want to go. All righty. We're going to continue our study here this morning in this survey of eschatology that we're doing in just a moment in Daniel chapter 5. Let's kind of review how we got to here. Chapter 1 was a setup chapter. It gave us the background information about what's going on in this book, and it picks up the storyline at about 600 years before Christ. 600 B.C. is when the book of Daniel starts, roughly. We could be more precise, but we don't have to be. It's about that time frame. And in chapter 1, we saw that what was going on there is that God was judging Judah, the last of the Davidic kingdom, because of their sins and idolatry and so on. And as part of that judgment, he's using one nation to judge another nation. He's using the nation of Babylon to judge Judah. That principle applies throughout all of history. God uses nations to judge nations. And we see that throughout the scriptures. He also sovereignly protected Daniel in that process and brought him up to Babylon, where he is working, in essence, in the Babylonian government. So he's right close to Nebuchadnezzar, the leader of the Babylonian government, and that's how the storyline begins there in chapter 1. In chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has this dream, and it is it involves a statue, and the statue is segmented into four different segments. There's a picture of it on the left there. You wonder why a dream like that would worry Nebuchadnezzar, would you? That doesn't look all that awesome. But I guess it must have been more than this drawing here shows. But it's segmented into four different segments, and the explanation for it that Daniel was given by God was that each of those segments represent a Gentile world kingdom. And it began with the top segment up there, the head, was the Babylonian Empire, Nebuchadnezzar. Then the next segment down here, which includes these two arms, was the Medo-Persian Empire. And I guess the arms, one represents the Medes and one represents the Persians. Who are the Persians, by the way, today? In Iran, that's who they are. Then the third section down here represented Greece. And the fourth one represented Rome. And an interesting facet to it was it also included 10 toes down here of iron and clay, a different mixture than any of the other part up there. And what that vision showed anybody who would read it and pay any attention to it is that there will be these four Gentile world powers that will dominate and control the Jews in their future. And so there, it's that whole period of time now from 600 B.C. up here, just before, well, at the time of Babylon, all the way down to the return of Christ here, is known as the time of the Gentiles. That's when those four Gentile nations and that ten-toed aspect to the Roman Empire will run its course. So we know that the Jews are going to be dominated for, they didn't know it at the time, but we know it today, for at least 2,600 years. All they know is they're going to be under Gentile domination for some unknown period of time to them. So in chapter 3 then, a lesson is taught to them about, well, how is it that they're going to be able to live under Gentile domination for all that time? And we have the lesson from the fiery furnace. Remember Daniel's three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? That's their Babylonian names. They were thrown into a fiery furnace for refusing to bow down to and worship and obey Nebuchadnezzar's symbol of his empire and of himself, a thing kind of like the Washington Monument, maybe an obelisk like thing. But what happened to them? Well, God protected them, didn't he? He actually joined them in the fiery furnace, and they were protected so thoroughly that there wasn't even any smell of smoke on their clothing. That's pretty cool. You can get that by just being in a room with somebody smoking, can't you? They got nothing. He protected him so well. So the lesson of Daniel chapter 3 was that God will protect his own even under difficult and persecuting circumstances from other people's. And we have a New Testament principle that illustrates, don't we? 2 Peter 2:9, God is able to deliver his own from testings and trials while keeping the unrighteous reserved for the day of judgment. And that New Testament principle is illustrated there by the experience in Daniel chapter 3. Then in Daniel chapter 4, we get the lesson that tells us, well, how can we believe that God can take care of us and protect us under all those different circumstances? And the lesson in Daniel chapter 4 illustrates that. The lesson of Daniel chapter 4 is that God is large and in charge. He controls the affairs of all men, all nations, all peoples, individually, collectively, nationally, any way you want to cut it. God controls and protects us, and so he can do just what he promised by the illustration in Daniel chapter 3. He can take care of us and protect us at all times. So that gets us up to where we are here this morning in Daniel chapter 5. Chapter 5 will go on with lessons that the Jewish people in particular, during the tribulation period, when they read this book, it will be very helpful to them. Let's look at Daniel chapter 5, see what we can learn from it. Daniel 5, 1. Belshazzar, the king, who's that guy? The last we knew of a king, it was Nebuchadnezzar. Who's this guy, Belshazzar? Wasn't that Daniel's name? No, his name was Belteshazzar. Not the same name. This is a different guy. This guy is actually in the line of replacement of Nebuchadnezzar. Here are your Babylonian kings during this little time frame right here. Nebuchadnezzar's father, Nebuchadnezzar, and he ruled for 43 years. Then these guys here were his sons and sons-in-laws and so on that tried to replace him, in effect. He died in 562 right there. These guys come along afterwards. They're kind of non-players. They only reign for a year or two, most of them. And then here's this guy, Nabonidus. He then was ruling from about 556 down to what we're going to see happen here this morning. And he had a way of not hanging around the country so real very much. He was gone all the time. One seven-year stretch, he didn't even set foot in Babylon. So his son, this guy, Belshazzar, is named a co-regent with him. So during the time period from right in through here on down to here, 553 to 539, two people are ruling Babylon, Nabonidus and Belshazzar, who is probably Nebuchadnezzar's grandson. So Nebuchadnezzar's dead and gone, and the leadership of Babylon isn't nearly as good as it used to be. This guy isn't that great, and this guy is even worse than that. So Belshazzar is now the co-regent of Babylon at this time frame of chapter 5, which is right here. So that's why he's called the king. He's actually a co-king with his father, Nabonidus, and he's trying to rule Babylon. So he throws a feast for 1,000 of his nobles. Why is he doing that? Well, what the scriptures don't tell us, but other things do, is that there is another empire right outside the door knocking on it saying, "Let us in, would you please?" And that empire is the Medes and the Persians. The Medo-Persian Empire is trying to take Babylon at this particular time. Remember what that vision that Daniel had earlier about the four Gentile world powers? I mean, the statue? Remember what this thing told him? What was the second empire there that was going to replace the Babylonian Empire? This one right here? the Medo-Persian Empire. This vision told them that there was going to be this succession of four Gentile world powers, and all of a sudden now, the second one of these, this one right here, is knocking on the door of Babylon, the Medo-Persian Empire. A collection of the Medes and the Persians. Can you see that pink? Can you see all this pink stuff here? That's the Medo-Persian Empire. And here's Babylon, and it's actually going to be incorporated into this one now. They're going to absorb it. So all of these guys are now becoming the dominant empire of the world, and they're going to take over this one. So the second segment of that statue vision is now coming into play here. And they're right outside the door. They're trying to take the city. And so this guy, apparently in an attempt to sort of shore up the confidence of his Babylonian citizenry, he's having this feast to kind of act like, who cares about these guys out there? They can't penetrate this city. They had enough food in that city to last over 20 years. And it's built on a river. So they think they got food and water. They don't care about the Medes and the Persians, or at least that's what he's trying to convey here by having this feast. So he invites 1,000 of his nobles, and he was drinking wine in the presence of the 1,000. So they just trying to look unconcerned, trying to look like they can't possibly, those Medes and Persians can't possibly come in here and take us over. And so when Belshazzar tasted the wine, he gave orders to bring the gold and silver vessels, which Nebuchadnezzar, his father, by the way, they don't have a word for grandfather in the Aramaic, so it's father is just an ancestor. You don't know how many generations are being talked about if you don't have some more information. So this is not his actual father. Nabonidus was his father. This was his Nebuchadnezzar was his grandfather. And he is the one that had taken them out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, in order that his kings and nobles, his wives and his concubines, might drink from them. So what Belshazzar has done is he's, in order to try to display his contempt for a different god than the Babylonian god, the Jewish god, he goes and gets all the stuff they stole out of the true God's temple in Jerusalem and brings them into the room, and they're all going to drink out of them. It's a display of contempt for the true God. Is that a smart move on his part, you think? Showing contempt for God? Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God, which was in Jerusalem, and the kings and his nobles, his wives, his concubines, drank from them. And they drank the wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. So they praised their own gods, idols, while displaying contempt for the true God. You think this guy's got a lengthy future ahead of him? I would bet on him. So while they're in the act of contemptuously ridiculing and just insulting the true God, suddenly the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the back of the hand that did the writing. Get the picture? There's not a man standing there writing. There's just a hand starting to write on the wall in this room where they're having this feast. And the king's face grew pale. I bet it did. And his thoughts alarmed him, and his hip joints went slack, and his knees began to knock together. I guess he tried to stand up, and he's just falling apart, because he sees not a whole body, but a hand only writing something on the wall in the room where they're displaying contempt for God. So the king called aloud to bring in the conjurers, the Chaldeans, and the diviners. The king spoke and said to the wise men of Babylon, "Any man who can read this inscription and explain its interpretation to me will be clothed with purple, have a necklace of gold around his neck, and have authority as third ruler in the kingdom." The reason is the highest he can give out is the third rule is, remember, his father is one of them and he's the other one. You can only be number three here. These two guys are already in place. So what he's offering is that he will make a second co-regent, a third ruler in the kingdom, if anybody can answer, what the heck is this? What does it mean? Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the inscription or make known its interpretation to the king. So then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed. His face grew even paler, and his nobles were perplexed. So he's essentially falling apart here. All of a sudden, that bravado that he's trying to demonstrate to his nobles, that they don't need to worry about the Medes and the Persians or anything like that, because, hey, we're cool, we're the Babylonians. We got all we need here, they can't take us. He's just crashing and burning. And his people cannot help him. But look who saves the day. Dear old mom. The queen entered the banquet hall. This would probably be the queen mother, I think, rather than his wife. This would be his mother. She comes in because of the words of the king and his nobles. She hears what's going on. And she spoke and said, O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts alarm you or your face be pale. There's a man in your kingdom in whom is a spirit of the holy gods. And in the days of your father, I think it means it would be his grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar, illumination, insight, and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods was found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, actually grandfather, your father the king, appointed him chief of the magicians, conjurers, Chaldeans, and diviners. Hey, we got a guy in the kingdom, son. He knows this stuff. Your grandfather actually appointed him over all of these people because he was so insightful in these sorts of things. This was because of an extraordinary spirit, knowledge and insight, interpretation of dreams, explanations of enigmas, and solving of difficult problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Don't confuse the two now. Belshazzar and Belteshazzar, two different people. Let Daniel now be summoned, and he will declare the interpretation. So dear old mom comes in there and saves this guy's bacon and says, look, you got a guy who can tell you what this is. No one else in your kingdom can do it, but he can. And she's the bridge back to Daniel under Nebuchadnezzar. So Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, are you that Daniel who is one of the exiles from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah? So he knows a little more about him than he's kind of let on here so far, doesn't he? He knows that he is a Jewish exile from Judah, and that Nebuchadnezzar had brought him there earlier. That's chapter 1. Now, I've heard about you, that a spirit of the gods is in you. Yeah, he just heard it from his mother. And that illumination, insight, and extraordinary wisdom has been found in you. Just now, the wise men and the conjurers were brought in before me, that they might read this inscription and make its interpretation known to me, but they could not declare the interpretation of the message. But I personally have heard about you, that you are able to give interpretations and solve difficult problems. Now, if you're able to read the inscription and make its interpretation known to me, you will be clothed with purple, wear a necklace of gold around your neck, and you'll have authority as the third ruler in the kingdom. Like most of these guys, they think they can throw money at a problem and get it solved. So, hey, I'll throw some at you, Daniel, if you can tell me what this writing means. So Daniel answered verse 17, and he said, keep your gifts for yourself or give your rewards to someone else. That is, he wouldn't necessarily want to be rewarded by this guy for doing God's work. However, I will read the inscription to the king and make the interpretation known to him. So he says, look, I'll help you out here. I'll read this and tell you what it means, but I don't want your reward. O king, the Most High God granted sovereignty, grandeur, glory, and majesty to Nebuchadnezzar, your father. Sounds a little bit like a summary of chapter 3 there again, doesn't it? or excuse me, chapter 4, God being sovereign over the affairs of men. So he kind of reminds him of that. And because of the grandeur which he, that is, that God had bestowed on him, Nebuchadnezzar, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language feared and trembled before him. Whomever he wished, he killed, and whomever he wished, he spared alive, and whomever he wished, he elevated, and whomever he wished, he humbled. Nebuchadnezzar was effectually a sovereign leader of that nation. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit became so proud that he behaved arrogantly, he was deposed from his royal throne and his glory was taken away from him. Is it possible this guy doesn't know that? I mean, you think something like that could be kept sort of a secret from succeeding generations? He was also driven away from mankind, and his heart was made like that of beasts, and his dwelling place was with the wild donkeys. And he was given grass to eat like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven, until he recognized that the Most High God is ruler over the realm of mankind, and that he sets over it whomever he wishes. Chapter 4. Go back and read chapter 4, Belteshazzar. That's what your grandfather had to learn the hard way, is that God is large and in charge. He is sovereignly in control of the affairs of men. And you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all this. This lesson was not kept from him. The lesson that his grandfather learned the hard way, he didn't learn at all. And you've exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven, and they've brought the vessels of his house before you. You and your nobles and your wives and your concubines have been drinking wine from them. And you've praised the gods of silver, gold, bronze, wood, and iron, stone, which don't see, hear, or understand. While you're worshiping your Babylonian idols, you are insulting the true God of heaven that is sovereign over the affairs of men, including you. But the God in whose hand you are, it are your life breath and your ways you have not glorified. Never good to insult God. And this guy made that mistake. Then the hand was sent from him, and this inscription was written out. This is a message from God, Belteshazzar, not your God. My God, the real God, the true God. Here's what he wrote. This is the inscription written out. Meeny, meeny, tekel, upharsin. Four words. Remember in Aramaic, you read them from right to left. And here's what it means, verse 26. The first word, meeny, means God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. This first word is a participle that means that something has been numbered. It has been kind of weighed out and judged as to its value and its worth. Which means that the days of Belteshazzar's kingdom has been weighed in the scales by God, and it's found to be greatly lacking. It doesn't measure up, and it therefore has been reckoned to be brought to an end. Second word is tekel. That kind of goes along with the numbering. It's a word that means weighed, and so it's been, again, kind of compared and see whether or not it's really worth anything. You've been weighed on the scales and found deficient. And the last word, euphorsin or peri, same word, your kingdom had been divided and given over to the Medes and the Persians. So the four words mean, in essence, your kingdom has been evaluated by God, and it has been found to be lacking. And so therefore it's coming to an end. And it's going to be divided between two other powers that are going to take it over, the Medes and the Persians. So kiss yourself goodbye, Belteshazzar. You are done. You're through. Your kingdom is over. And these Medes and Persians outside your gate that you think can't possibly take this place over, they're going to take it over. So, one might think that Belteshazzar would be really unhappy with this message. He might have turned on Daniel, but he didn't. He gave orders, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a necklace of gold around his neck, issued a proclamation concerning him that he now had authority as the third ruler in the kingdom. So he's now number three on the list of succession behind Nabonidus, Belteshazzar, and then him. That same night, Belteshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain that very night. So Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. Now what's happened here is that the Medes and the Persians figured out how to get into the city. Remember, it's built on a river. So the what's the river that flows through Babylon? What's that? Yeah, the Euphrates. Couldn't pull the word up. What they did was they cut a channel between the Euphrates River and a lake nearby and basically shunted off the water from the Euphrates River. That lowered the water level that flowed into the city so that they could get under the gates to the city in the water. Pretty cool move on their part, wasn't it? Diverted the river that sort of protected the place, and they got in there and they killed Belteshazzar, but they took over the kingdom sort of without firing a shot, so to speak. So all of this bravado he was trying to illustrate through the feast was for naught. And exactly what God had forecasted earlier in this vision came to pass. The second segment is now in place. How long did the Babylonian Empire, how long did they make it? Remember what Jeremiah told us? Jeremiah chapter 25. Jeremiah sent a message to the folks. Let me read you a few verses here. From the 13th year of Josiah, the son of Amon, king of Judah, even to this day, these 23 years, the word of the Lord came to me, and I've spoken to you again and again, but you have not listened to me. Jeremiah 25:4. The Lord has sent to you all his servants and the prophets again and again, but you have not listened. Verse 7. You have not listened to me. Jeremiah 25:12. Then it will be that when 70 years are completed, I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation, declares the Lord, for their iniquity, and the land of the Chaldeans, I will make it an everlasting desolation. So it was told to them by Jeremiah that when 70 years of Babylonian captivity had ran their course, God would punish the Babylonians. And that's exactly what's happened here. From early 600s down to 539, roughly 70 years here, is now over. So the next Gentile world power given to us by that vision of that statue has now come onto the scene, the Medo-Persian Empire. So the vision is being fulfilled right in front of these people. For any of them that happen to know about it. So that's Daniel chapter 5. The sovereign God of mankind that controls the affairs of men, that can raise up nations and bring down nations however he wishes, just illustrated that point by tearing down the Babylonian Empire and having it taken over by the Medo-Persian Empire. Now, if that happened between segment 1 and 2, do you think that it won't happen between segment 2 and 3 or segment 3 and 4? whatever that fourth one is all about? Of course it will. So the prophecy given by that statue has come to pass. So God can take care of his own because he's sovereign over the affairs of men, as illustrated by these different world empires coming and going, just as he said. That would put Daniel at about 80 to maybe 85 years of age when all of this happened there in 539. So Daniel's starting to get a little age on him. So let's go on in chapter 6 and see what happens to him under the new regime. Now he's not working for the Babylonian Empire. He's working for the Medo-Persian Empire, isn't he? So when Darius takes over as leader of the new Medo-Persian Empire, which includes the old Babylonian Empire, he decides he wants to kind of reorganize things, and he's going to put 120, let's call them governors, over the entire nation of Medo-Persia, 120 satraps, that this should be in charge of the whole kingdom, and over them, three commissioners. So each of these 120, I guess, broken down into groups of 40, will report to a commissioner. So that there's three commissioners that reports to Darius, and under each of those three are 40 governors throughout the kingdom. And Daniel was appointed one of those three commissioners. So not only was he occupying a high position of government in the Babylonian Empire, now he's doing the same thing in the Medo-Persian Empire. God has kept him in place to do this. So he began distinguishing himself among these three commissioners and the satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit. We might call it today a godliness, a godly spirit. Daniel had a spiritual compass. He had a moral compass that he lived his life by. And as such, he was a great leader. Would that we had leaders that had either one of those. But we don't. So the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. He was doing so well, distinguishing himself, even at this advanced age, over the other two, that Darius said, well, I'm going to put this guy in charge of the whole thing. Well, I think there's any chance that that might not have gone over real well with the other two governors and or commissioners and the various governors, Daniel being this Jewish guy that they drug up there from Judah 70 years before. Now, the commissioners and the satraps begin trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs. They wanted to nail him somehow and get rid of the guy. But they couldn't find any ground of accusation or evidence of corruption. Inasmuch as he was faithful and no negligence or corruption was found in him. Can you believe that? That there's a guy in government somewhere that you can't find some dirt on? Today, you couldn't find a clean guy in government because the dirt would be too hard to get through to get to the guy. Corruption prevails everywhere. But not in Daniel's day, not in Daniel's life. They couldn't find anything to nail him with. And so they admit it. Verse 5. These men said, well, we're not going to find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God. They knew he was so pious and so faithful in behaving before God that they couldn't find anything other than some offense, perhaps, that involved his God, because he was a man of utmost character and uncorrupt. So then these commissioners and satraps came by agreement to the king and spoke to him as follows. King Darius, live forever. All the commissioners of the kingdom, all except Daniel, they should have said, The prefects, the satraps, the high officials, the governors have consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction, that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den. So that's their plan. They're going to say, look, we all got together and we decided that you ought to make this law that says if anybody worships anybody other than you, you're to make cat food out of them. Throw them in a lion's den. How's that sound, old king? How's that sound? Because they're kind of lathering him up pretty good, aren't they? And so now, old king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed. Once it's signed, it can't be altered, was the rule of the Medo-Persian Empire, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. So once this law is put in place, even he could not revoke it. Therefore, King Darius signed the document, that is, the injunction. So they got the stage set. Their trap is laid in it. Anybody that worships anyone other than Darius for the next 30 days gets fed to the lions. So, when Daniel knew the document was signed, he entered his house, as in his roof chamber he had windows open toward Jerusalem, and he continued kneeling on his knees three times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God as they had been doing previously. Why does he continue that process, that procedure, knowing that this document had been signed? Could he not have a private room somewhere? Does he have to keep doing this in public so that it's inevitable that someone will see him? Apparently, Daniel was leaving quite a testimony for godliness amongst the Jewish community there in Babylon. And it appears that he thinks that it is more important for him to maintain that testimony than to protect his own life. So he continues to worship God, prays to God three times a day, just like he had been done before. And rather than change his life to conform to this satanic plot, he decides he's going to keep right on doing this, hopefully then being enough of a testimony to the other Jews living there in exile to continue to live for God, that he'd rather do that than protect himself. So, these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and supplication before his God. So they knew he was going to be there at certain times of the day. They got all their cell phones out and started snapping pictures of him, praying to God and so on, so that they could rat him out to Darius. Then they approached and spoke before the king about the king's injunction. Hey, did you not sign an injunction that any man who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days be cast into the lion's den? Didn't you sign that document that we brought up here to you? And the king answered and said, well, the statement is true according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. And then they said to the king, well, Daniel, who's one of the exiles from Judah, he pays no attention to you, O king. Obviously, they spin this in as negative a way as they can. They didn't say, well, he honors his God even more than you. They said, no, he pays no attention to you. He's dissing you, Darius, when he, of course, was not doing that at all. Or the injunction which you signed, but keeps making his petition three times a day. Then as soon as the king heard this statement, he was deeply distressed. Why is he distressed? Because he knows Daniel. He knows the character of this man. and he means something to him. So he tries to deliver Daniel. He was distressed and set his mind on delivering Daniel, and even until sunset, he kept exerting himself to rescue him. So he knows that he's been trapped. He's trying to find some way to get Daniel out of the trap. But he can't. These three men came by agreement to the king and said to king, "Recognize, O king, that the law of the Medes and Persians that has no injunction or statute which the king establishes may be changed." You cannot change this law. Remember that, Darius. And I'm sure he's just boiling at them for trapping him like this. So the king gave orders to Daniel to bring him in and to be cast into the lion's den. And the king spoke and said to Daniel, "Your God, whom you constantly serve, he will himself deliver you." Now, don't know exactly what this guy knows about the true God of heaven, the one that demonstrated in chapter 4 that he controls the affairs of men, but he certainly has hope here that God will deliver Daniel. And that's his only way out. So a stone was brought and laid over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signet rings of his nobles, so that nothing might be changed in regards to Daniel. That is, humanly speaking, nothing would be changed. So the king went off to his palace and spent the night fasting with no entertainment. He was brought before him, and his sleep fled from him. He's really upset by this. He likes this guy. And he is miffed that he's been trapped into killing him, he thinks, possibly. So he spends a restless night because of all of this. He rose the next day to break a day and went in haste to the lion's den. And when he came near to the lion's den, he cried out with a troubled voice. The king spoke and said to Daniel, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lion's?" Now, this whole incident is sort of like, it's a preview of what the Jewish people are going to be experienced during the tribulation period. They will be persecuted by all men on earth. They will have no allies whatsoever. They will be the most hated people on earth. And the question is, can God deliver them? Can God not let them be cat food? So when they read this book during the tribulation period, this lesson will be, I think, very meaningful to them. So Darius calls out, and Daniel calls back to him, "O king, live forever." Obviously, he is okay and well, or he couldn't be talking back. "My God sent his angel and shut the lion's mouth, and they've not harmed me. Why? Inasmuch as I was found innocent before him, and also toward you, O king, I have committed no crime." That's the justification, Daniel says, for his deliverance, is that he is not offended. His God or Darius, either one. And that God then sent an angel to protect him, just like he did Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego earlier in the fiery furnace. Now, these lions, as we'll see in just a moment, weren't just too full to eat or wanting to just take a nap and do nothing. They clearly were silenced by divine decree and empowerment. So the king was very pleased when he sees this, and he gave orders for Daniel to be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever was found on him because he had trusted his God. Faith brought about blessing for Daniel. So the king then gave orders, and they brought those men who had maliciously accused Daniel and cast them and their children and their wives into the lion's den. And they had not even reached the bottom of the den before the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Sometimes our sins affect others, don't they? Fathers of households need to understand this principle for sure. Their sins can affect the entire household, as is the case here. These people didn't even get it to the bottom of the lion's den before the lions were eating them. These weren't passive, toothless old lions. These were vicious big cats, and they defied these people in judgment because of what they had done. So Darius the king wrote to all the peoples, nations, and men of every language who were living in all the land, "May your peace abound. I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel." Similar to what Nebuchadnezzar had done as a result of his 7 years of being a cow. Issues a decree and tells people, don't be bad-mouthing this God. "For he is the living God and enduring forever. His kingdom is one which will not be destroyed, and his dominion will be forever. He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. Who has also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions." Who knows whether this guy, like Nebuchadnezzar, came to faith or not. Those are some pretty insightful descriptions there of God and his power and so on. Who knows? Maybe. So this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. So Daniel was also blessed by God under the reign of the Medo-Persians as well as he was under the Babylonians. Obedience brought blessing to Daniel throughout his entire life. And that is a principle of life that we all can participate in. It too illustrates 2 Peter 2:9. God is able to deliver the righteous from testings and trials while reserving the unrighteous for the day of judgment. God can protect and deliver his people from difficult circumstances, as he just illustrated here. So, again, to the Jews reading this book during the tribulation period, when they are the most despised people on earth, this experience will be an encouragement to them. God can do that. He can deliver his own from these kinds of circumstances. So the lessons are piling up. The lessons for the Jewish reader later on are piling up. They are also illustrating some of our New Testament doctrines at the same time. And hopefully this book will be that kind of a source of comfort for them during the tribulation period. Any questions or comments about either chapter 5 or 6? There's some notes in your handout also about what we just talked about, too, so you got it in writing as well. Yeah, Arch.
You always heard the phrase, handwriting on the wall.
Yeah.
Is that anywhere else in the Bible other than Daniel?
Well, the metaphor can be used anywhere, of course, but I don't think there's ever another incident like this, this real-life incident. And clearly, the lesson from the incident is repeated in many places. Oftentimes we get a foreshadowing of something that's coming, like here, but this was the real thing. This was the basis for that saying. Handwriting on the wall is usually some kind of an omen, some kind of a foreshadowing of something that's about to take place, and it certainly was here, wasn't it? Any other questions or comments? Now, we're going to have two more visions in the next two chapters, 7 and 8, which are very much like what we saw there in chapter 2. Four Gentile world powers dominating the Jews for a long time, one succeeding the other, and ending with the destruction of them by Messiah. He's that stone cut without hands that crashes that statue's fourth segment on the feet. Remember that back in chapter 2? Crashes it on the feet, and the whole thing just crashes and blows. It gets blown away by the wind. So the next two chapters, 7 and 8, will be sort of repeats of that same basic truth. They're embellished a little differently, but that's what we're going to see as we go forward. So more to come there. And a little more information about that statue. We still haven't come to a real good description yet, have we, of the 10 toes? We've kind of got everything else pretty well in mind. We know these four empires are going to succeed one another. We've seen two of them right here already in the book of Daniel. We'll see the Greeks also come about, the third one, and some of the fourth one. But we don't quite know how that fourth one ends. It doesn't end completely like the first three. The first three are all absorbed by the next one. And we don't know quite how to describe the 10 toes yet, do we? They're clay. That ain't much of a substance, is it? That's kind of worthless. Yeah, very weak. Doesn't it here? Doesn't do much of anything. Clay doesn't. So we'll get more information about those 10 toes as we go forward in our survey. So far we don't know a whole lot about them other than it is somehow related to that fourth empire, which is the Roman Empire, and it seems to somehow or another come back around. And we'll see how that all works out before we're done. It will come back around, matter of fact. Any other questions or comments? Yeah.
Was the whole of Babylon surrounded by a wall, or just
the whole city of Babylon was surrounded by a wall?
The whole city.
Very thick wall. Sometimes these walls were so thick they could drive chariots on top of them. 20, 30 feet thick. And they had so much provision inside the city, and that city was so impenetrable that they thought they had nothing to fear from the Medes and the Persians. Somebody should have been out there watching that river, and they didn't realize what had happened to them, and they got taken over. And we will see that same principle. God uses nations to judge other nations. We'll see that over and over and over again throughout this survey we're going through. Any other questions or comments? Okay, we'll let you roll. And we will see you, Lord willing, and the creek doesn't rise, next Thursday. So you have a good week.